The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I'd like to share with you a very profound experience that I had many, many years ago. I guess it happened about 17 years ago. My friend and I were walking in an area in Jerusalem called Geula. Are people familiar with that? Have you been to Jerusalem? So in Jerusalem, there's an area called Geula. And my friend turns to me and he says, "Have you ever seen the Lilavar Rebbe, the great Hasidic, Kabbalistic master, the Lilavar Rebbe?" I was a little embarrassed. I'd never even heard of him, let alone see him. I don't know who he is. Said he is one of the greatest Hasidic masters and Kabbalistic greats of our generation. And the reason why he brought up the Lilavar's name is because we happened to be walking down the street where the Rebbe Lilavar has his center. And sure enough, as we're getting closer to the center, we see that there are thousands of people going in and out, and there was some kind of event going on. And it was Rosh Chodesh, it was the beginning of the new month, and so we figured, you know, maybe the Rebbe is hosting a tish. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the Yiddish word tish. A tish is a table. And what happens in the Hasidic world is they get together, they have a long table, and the Rebbe says over words of Torah, of Kabbalah. They sing songs, they do some dancing, they do some eating. And so we figured maybe the Rebbe is doing a tish. So we said, let's go inside, let's see what's going on. So we walked into the room. The room was packed. My friend and I walked in the door. The Rebbe was standing, and he was peeling an apple. As I walked into the room, my friend and I walked into the room, the Rebbe went, "Ha!" And he stopped and stared in our direction. Well, I don't know. You know, you walk into a room, you hear somebody go, "Ha!" You figure it's some kind of meditation, some kind of chant. What do I know? So my friend and I moved over onto the side, but the Rebbe continued to stare. And then people in the room realized that somebody or something has caught the eyes of the Rebbe. So people also started to stare. Right? My friend and I, my heart started to race. I got a little nervous what the Rebbe's staring at. And people are looking. My friend and I were at the back of the room, so we were also looking. But of course, there was only a wall. Well, then the Rebbe began to point. And everyone's looking. Who's the Rebbe pointing at? Who's the Rebbe pointing at? Now, at that point, right, my hair started to turn red. And so, the Rebbe started pointing. People wonder, who's the Rebbe pointing at? Who's the Rebbe pointing at? Before I knew it, the entire room was pointing at my friend and I. And at that point, I was no longer 6 foot. And I know that's hard for you to believe, I was once 6 foot. And the Rebbe wanted to see us. So I'm a pretty brave guy. So I put my friend in front of me, and we started going up towards the Rebbe. Two of the followers of the Rebbe, grabbed my friend. He would be the first sacrifice. I was happy. And so they pushed them through the crowd towards the Rebbe. And the Rebbe had very intense eyes. And he started to ask my friend some questions. I couldn't exactly hear what was going on. And before I know it, he's finished with my friend, and he starts screaming in Yiddish, "Where's the other one? Where's the other one?" Oh my gosh. I think I'm the other one. Sure enough, two Hasidim grab me and start pushing me through the crowd. And now I'm standing in front of this Rebbe. He's a very intense man. Very bizarre eyes that go like this. Doesn't look at you. He looks all over you. He consumes you with his eyes. Very intense man. And this is what he says to me. He says in Hebrew, "Me'eza eda ataba," which literally translates means, "From what congregation do you come?" Now that's a little strange in Israel, because people don't really belong to congregations. So I thought that was very strange. Like, you mean like Adath Israel or Sheret Tefillah or Beth Shalom? I thought this was a very strange, strange question. So I said to the Rebbe, at that time I had a perfect Hebrew. I said, Slicha, excuse me. That was all I knew, right? So I said, Slicha. So the Rebbe said, Me'iza Eida Ataba. For what congregation do you come? I started thinking, oh my gosh, this man has seen all my past lives. He probably remembered that some other past life I didn't pay my dues in some shul. I'm in big trouble. So I said in my perfect Hebrew, Slicha. So the Rebbe says like this. He says, are you an Ashkenazi or are you a Sfardi? Now I tell you, no one has ever asked me that question. And I thought it was very strange. Because growing up, people thought I was Irish. Right? So to all of a sudden start to discuss whether I'm Ashkenazi from an Eastern European background or whether I'm from a more Northern African background, I thought that was a little strange. So I told the Rebbe, I said, Ani Ashkenazi. I'm an Ashkenazi. The Rebbe looks at me with utter disbelief. He says, you're an Ashkenazi? I said, yes, I am. He says, are you sure you're an Ashkenazi? Now I'm really having an identity crisis here. You know, it's bad enough my hair turned red. Now you're questioning me. I'm okay. I said, yes, I'm an Ashkenazi. He says, where's your mother from? I said, my mother's from Vilna. Where's your father from? My father's from Russia. He says, you're an Ashkenazi? I say, yes. He turns to the crowd and says, an Ashkenazi. An Ashkenazi. And everyone in the room is going, an Ashkenazi, an Ashkenazi, an Ashkenazi. I felt like the beginning of the Fiddler on the Roof, you know, was it a horse or a mule? So he says, an Ashkenazi. I said, yes, I'm an Ashkenazi. All right. He finally accepted it. Then the Rebbe took the apple that was in his hand, held it by the stem, and dramatically held it up like this to me. The Rebbe was going to give me his apple. Okay. So I reached to take the apple. As I'm reaching for taking the apple, the whole room screams, no! And I don't understand. The Rebbe looks at me. He's very patient. Once again, he holds the apple up like this. And I reach to take the apple. And sure enough, as I'm reaching, everyone screams, no! And I don't know what to do. Then the entire room goes like this. So I realize with my Talmudic mind, wait a second. Not like this, but like this. Okay? I don't know. So the Rebbe looked at me, held the apple again with the stem. And I reached out like this. The Rebbe dropped the apple in my hand. Two Hasidim grabbed me and pulled me out of the crowd. Very strange. It gets stranger. The Rebbe started to say over words of Torah. They did a little singing. The Rebbe was sitting at his table. And he kicks off from the table in his chair. Something's about to happen. The Rebbe gets up. The man was in his 80s. And he does an Olympic sprint across the room. Running across the room to the front door. He puts his hand on the mezuzah. And he starts to do some kind of chanting, some kind of praying. And suddenly turns around. Runs again. Everybody's kind of like moving out of the way. They don't know which way the Rebbe's going to run. The Rebbe runs to the ark where the Torah is. He puts his hands on the ark and he starts to pray. Then suddenly he turns around again and he's running. And he's running and people are moving out of the way. Don't know which way the Rebbe's going to run. The Rebbe, he stops on a dime, turns around, looks me in the face and says, what are you learning? I don't understand what's going on. How did he see me? This man is running randomly around this room. The room is packed. He stops on a dime, turns around with his finger and he goes, what are you learning? I'm learning, yes, what are you learning? I'm learning Talmud. I'm learning Talmud. You know Gemara? Talmud? The Rebbe says, Talmud? He says, what tractate? What section? What book of the Talmud? What volume? A Shabbat. I'm learning Shabbat. Talmud Shabbat. The Rebbe looked at me, and he started to laugh. And he ran away. And I'm telling you, I didn't know what was flying. People start coming up to me, shaking my hand. You know, like, I guess I passed the test. I don't know. Listen, I don't know. When I walked out of the room, my friend said, what was that all about? I said, I don't know. I don't know. But you know what? I was frightened because I did know. You see, at that time, I was in my early 20s. I was doing something a little unusual for a yeshiva boy in his early 20s. I was studying Kabbalah. I was studying Kabbalah. And you should know something. What does the word Kabbalah really literally mean? Kabbalah literally means to receive. To receive. What was the Rebbe telling me with this apple? What's the difference if I go like this or if I go like this? This is taking. This is receiving. The Rebbe was hinting something to me. I had obviously missed the entire point of Kabbalah. I was studying it, but I didn't really, so to speak, chap it. I didn't really catch it. Kabbalah is the art and the secret of receptivity. Learning to receive, not to take, but to receive. Now you should know something very fascinating. In the Kabbalistic tradition, there are actually two schools of thought. The Ashkenazic school of thought and the Sfardi school of thought. There's the works of the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, which is the Kabbalistic school from the Ashkenazic world. But then in the Sfardi world, the Rashash. And what's a nice Ashkenazic boy like me studying the Sfardi Kabbalah? But that's what I was doing. I was immersed most of my day studying Kabbalah, the art of receptivity. I had obviously missed the point. And he couldn't understand why an Ashkenazi was studying the Sfardi Kabbalah. So I want to talk about what Kabbalah really is. And there's just so much to say, and I hope I'll have the opportunity to share with you more tomorrow night when I explore the meaning and the power and the energy of love based on the Kabbalah. But tonight I just want to get to the essence, the initial idea of Kabbalah, the secret of receptivity. So I want to share with you a metaphor. The Kabbalah speaks in metaphor. The truth is we speak in metaphor. We're always speaking in metaphor. You see, people think this is a hand. I don't know what this is. We call it a hand. It's a label, H-A-N-D. Everybody thinks, oh, I got one too. We all have hands. You don't have this, right? This is unique. The word H-A-N-D is a symbol. It's a metaphor for this. We live in metaphors. We speak in metaphors. The Kabbalah, one of the dangers is when people take the Kabbalah literally and forget that it too is a metaphor. And so I want to share with you the metaphor of the Kabbalah. And there's just so much to share. But just a little bit. The Kabbalah starts off like this. The Kabbalah says that in the beginning, all of existence was a perfect, endless light. A divine light. Suggesting something about our existence as some kind of divine revelation. When the divine, when the Ein Sof, when the Endless One wanted to create the worlds, the Ein Sof, the Endless One, caused the withdrawal of the light from the center, creating a vacuum. In this vacuum, the Endless One created vessels. Vessels. And then the Endless One projected a thin ray of endless light into the vessel. Now, of course, how do you have a thin ray of endless light? You're taking it too seriously. It's a metaphor. It's supposed to take you somewhere experientially. What happens when the Endless One projects this light into the vessels? They explode. The Kabbalistic Big Bang Theory. Something breaks down. These vessels can't take the light. And they break down. And the universe goes into chaos. And there's a huge amount to be discussed here. But I only want to focus on one aspect of this story. The continuation of the story, the Kabbalah tells us, is what's called tikkun. The breaking of the vessel is called shvirat hakelim. And then the fixing of the vessels is referred to as tikkun, the fixing. So I want to ask a couple questions and I want to try and understand it. First of all, what is this light? What is this light? What is it that the divine, the endless one, is giving over to the vessels? Why did the vessels break? Why were they not able to take this light? And surely if the divine is omniscient, all-knowing, certainly doesn't God know that they won't be able to take the light? And now that this chaos, this breakdown has happened, what do we do about it? How do we fix our broken vessels? And so let's talk a little bit about this light. The Kabbalah says something very interesting. The Kabbalah says that the purpose of the universe is that the divine, God, Hashem, wants to give ultimate goodness to others. And I know that raises a lot of questions. A lot of questions. But that's what it says. Lahativ mituvo lezulato. To give of the divine goodness to otherness. Now, what's the greatest goodness? What is the greatest goodness you could give to somebody? What's the greatest goodness? Got a lot of different... Okay. You know, when I think of my own childhood, and I think of the great moments that my parents gave me, there's one moment that comes to me all the time. And it seems to be an insignificant moment, but for some reason, it's one of the most cherished moments of my life. I'm lying in bed, and my mother is sitting beside me. And she's reading to me Winnie the Pooh. Now, my mother's from Eastern Europe, so she's got a nice Yiddish accent. And so I didn't grow up with Winnie the Pooh. I grew up with Winnie the Pooh. You know? All my friends were with Winnie, and I had Winnie. But you know, it was a very special moment. I was lying there. I must have been 25 years old. I'm just joking. I was about 7 years old. And it's just so vivid. My mother is right there. And she's reading to me Winnie the Pooh. Now, why is that so special? Because my mother was giving me her presence. My mother was there for me. And I know that my mother never read Winnie any other time. She was bringing all her being, her total presence, and she was giving it to me. And that was a special, special moment. What's the greatest gift we as parents can give to our children? What's the greatest gift a husband can give his wife? A wife can give her husband. Children can give their parents. It's presence. It's being there. Being there for the person. Really being there. This is the greatest gift. This is what's called in Torah, in Midrash, in Kabbalah, the Shekhinah, the divine presence. The divine presence. You know, I do these lectures, travel the States, significant amount of time. And you know, it's a little hard. Can you know how I have 6 kids waiting for me in Shalayim? And remember after one trip I came home, I said to the kids, I'd been away for a number of weeks, I said, hey, let's go into town, I'll take you out to dinner. The kids said, great. So I live in the old city of Jerusalem, we're walking out Jaffa Gate, we're walking towards town, and I turn to my children, I say, so what would you like, Italian or Chinese? You know, like Jerusalem, you know, who eats falafel, okay? So I said, what would you like, Italian and Chinese. My son, 6 years old, turned to me and said, I want you. I heard something rip somewhere around here. My son wants me. Ah, I can't believe it. I thought my kid wants Chinese food. Oh, Dad, if you want to eat, fine. I just want to be with you. I just want your presence. I just want your presence. This is one of the greatest gifts we can give to each other, is presence. Being there for people. Being there for our children. Being there for our beloved. And so, you know, I had a relative, very successful businessman. His son was chosen from the entire school to put the mezuzah up on the new wing of the school. So, my cousin's wife calls him up. Sweetheart, terrific news. Little Joey got, you know, honored. He's going to be giving the mezuzah. He's going to put the mezuzah on the door. Of course you're going to be there, right? Oh, honey. Gee, you know, things are so hectic in the office. I mean, this, I just can't. But, you know, it's okay. I'll buy him that bicycle. You know that bicycle he always wanted? I'll buy him that bicycle. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. It won't be fine. It won't be fine. You see, we try to fool ourselves sometimes that you can give people presents, gifts, and that'll substitute for presence, really being there. You can't do it. You just can't do it. Toys are not us. They really aren't. And you know, sometimes we fool our children, we fool ourselves, we think, ah, I'll give them this, I'll give them that, I'll give them this. What do you want to really give them? You got to give them presents. Now, this is what the Kabbalah is teaching. The Kabbalah is teaching that the greatest gift is to feel God's presence in our lives. To feel God's presence in our lives. And the question is, how do we do that? How do we do that? What went wrong? What was God giving these vessels? His light, His presence, His imminence, His closeness. But something went wrong. They couldn't deal with it. Why couldn't they deal with it? The Kabbalah says because they tried to take it rather than receive it. You can't take somebody's presence. You must receive it as a gift. It's a present, their presence. You can't control it. You can't own it. You can only share it. You can't consume it. You have to open your hands, your arms, your love, your heart to receive someone's presence without trying to control it, without trying to own it. So the vessels tried to consume this light. They tried to make it its own light. Rather than receive it and share it. But you know, didn't God know this? I mean, doesn't the divine understand the nature of these vessels that they couldn't take because they would try to take this divine light, this divine presence, and something went wrong? So I'm going to tell you something really amazing. The Kabbalah says that God wants to give Himself, His presence, to other. But here comes, when I learned this in the Kabbalah, it frightened me. Because the Kabbalah teaches us that there's something in this whole story which completely depends on you and me. That in a certain way, God is depending on each and every one of us for the fulfillment of this purpose. You see, if you want to give somebody your presence, there's something you need from them. You need them to want your presence. You need them to recognize that that is in fact what you're giving them. And if a person doesn't recognize your love, doesn't recognize your presence, and doesn't want it, you can't give it to them. Because even if you do give it to them, they didn't get it. I have to give you something you want. You know, I was dating this woman years ago. And at the time, I thought I loved her the most in the world. And I wanted to give her my entire self. And you know what? It just didn't go. She just couldn't believe that anybody would give their presence to her. She had such a weak sense of self that she could never recognize love. She could never receive love because she could never believe that anyone would give her that. And she couldn't receive it. You know, it's an oral tradition. It's a Jewish oral tradition. Woody Allen, that's the Jewish oral tradition, says, I would never date a woman who would date me. Because any woman who would date me is obviously not worth dating. But you should know this goes all the way back to Groucho Marx. I want you to know this is really an oral tradition of the Jewish people. I would never join a club that would have me as a member. Any club that would have me as a member is certainly not worth joining. To believe in ourselves. To believe that we could have that presence, that closeness in our lives. And you know, this is frightening. To me, it was very frightening when I realized how much this whole scheme from the Kabbalistic perspective is relying on me in each and every one of us to receive presence in our life, to receive that warmth and that closeness. We have to recognize that that's the ultimate goodness. And that's really what I want. That's really what I want. But the vessels didn't recognize it. They didn't understand. They tried to control. Tried to own. And so if God knew that would happen, so why in fact did God give His presence to vessels that weren't ready to acknowledge it, to understand it, to really want it? So this is what the Kabbalah says. Because if you never tasted it, you'd never know what you wanted. And this is really a fascinating idea. The Kabbalah teaches us that God gave that endless light to the vessels, even though it would be for a split moment, that would be enough to give us that metaphysical memory. Each and every one of us is born in this world with a metaphysical memory. We remember something ultimate. We don't know what it is. But we're born in this world yearning. And we spend a lot of time earning. But that's not enough. We're yearning. We come in this world and we have a memory of something quite awesome. Something quite deep. Something so profound, something so warm. And we come in this world and we're looking. And we're searching. And we don't exactly know what it is. We don't know what it is. And it's only when we really understand what it is that we want, we'll be able to receive it. And so much of our lives, and the way God orchestrates our lives, is to try and help us clarify what is truly good. What do I really, really want? You know, I realize that this is the Kabbalistic secret behind the Wizard of Oz. Did you ever see the Wizard of Oz? Terrific, right? I'm still seeing my therapist about those monkeys. But anyways, the Wizard of Oz is about this girl, Dorothy. She doesn't appreciate her home. She doesn't appreciate her family. And sure enough, she's in exile. Far away from home. And now she's stuck with a bunch of midgets, you know, with a bunch of munchkins, telling her, follow the yellow brick road, follow the yellow brick road. Now she's going to have to go around in circles. But now it's a big thing now. I want to go home. I want to end the M. Where are you? I want to go home. Before you were home, yeah, home. Now I'm not home. Oy, do I want home. Do I love home? Ah, it's all I want is home. Well, now it's not going to be so simple. So now she's got this long journey, difficult journey with great obstacles, and every good story has a wicked witch. But you know that wicked witch? She ain't so bad. She plays a terrific role. She makes us want what we want even more by taking it away from us. By taking it away from us, we want it even more. You know, when I was in high school, I was looking for a job. So saw in the newspaper this job for telephone sales. Figured, you know, you're 16 years old, you want to make a little money for the summer. So I applied. This thing was a theater. It was selling tickets to this theater. And this is what the fellow tells me. He says, listen, you call somebody up, you say, hey, Mr. So-and-so, I want you to know that you just won the opportunity to buy 3 tickets to the Fire Hall Theater. Right? I said, well, what if the guy says he's not interested? Ah, he says, are you sure you're not interested? Because I could take these tickets away from you. Right? Would you like me to give these tickets to somebody else? And the whole idea was to make the person feel that they're losing something. Ah, now they really want it. Now, I want you to know it didn't work in sales. Certainly not for Fire Hall. But for Dorothy, Dorothy is looking for something. And the difficulties that she's feeling is making her want it even more and more and more. Finally, the wizard. Ah, there's always a wizard in our life, right? That wizard, he's going to do everything for us. Right? He's going to take us home. And sure enough, as she's saying goodbye to all these munchkins, the wizard takes off in his balloon, and Dorothy breaks down in utter despair. Right? Utter despair. Her Mashiach has gone. Her Messiah has left her. And there she is crying. And sure enough, at that moment, who shows up? Glinda! The good witch Glinda! And Glinda comes, you know, and she sees Dorothy crying. She says, Dorothy, what's wrong? I want to go home. I want to go home. I want to go home. So Glinda says, Dorothy, no problem. All you got to do is click your heels 3 times and say, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. And I tell you, if I were Dorothy, I'd be so mad. I'd be so furious. I'd say, Glinda, where have you been? I mean, you couldn't have done this a little earlier, you know? You couldn't have stopped me from all those crazy flying monkeys. I mean, what's wrong with you, lady? Right? You see, Dorothy wasn't ready. Sometimes in our lives, we have to go through very difficult challenges to help us truly recognize what's really good and what do we really, really want. And when we recognize what is good and when we recognize what we really, really want in our lives, we'll be ready to receive it. We'll be ready to receive it. So God gave us a moment, a taste of the light, so that we'd be born in this world with a memory of where we want to get to. And we're hungry. And we're hungry. And you know, I find this so much the situation of our generation. We are a generation that is hungering. And so many don't know what they want. And there's just so much. That's what makes it so frustrating. The opportunities seem endless, and yet I'm still hungry. It's like, to me, it's almost like if you've ever had the experience where you open up the refrigerator door, you're feeling really hungry, and it's full. It's got fruit. It's got cake. It's got everything you can imagine, and nothing. Just nothing hits you. Nothing hits you. Have you ever closed that door, walk away, and come back 1 minute later, open up again, hoping that maybe something would appear? And nothing has appeared. And you close the door. You come back another minute later, open it up. We're hungry. What are we hungry? What are we hungry? You know, everybody knows that Adam and Eve were in this Garden of Eden. Didn't God know they'd eat of that tree? I want you to know the Midrash, the oral tradition says that at the end of the story, Adam turned to God and said, wait a second. Just 1 second. The tree in the middle of the garden, you could have put it somewhere in the corner behind some bush. Then you got the snake coming in saying, eat it, eat it, eat it. I mean, this is like, you know, someone baking a fresh batch of cookies, putting it in the center of your little boy's living room or bedroom, and then sending his brother in going, touch it, eat it, eat it. So the first man turns to the guy and says, wait a second. This is a setup. You set me up. And he says, this is analogous to a man who walks into his home. He's got a divorce document in his back pocket. He says, hi, sweetheart, I'm home. Can I have a drink? She says, sure, honey. Pours him a drink. Takes one gulp. He says, this is lukewarm. You're divorced. She turns and says, you knew it would be lukewarm. You had that divorce document in your back pocket. You set me up. That's what Adam says to God. You set me up. And you know what God answers? God doesn't answer in this midrash. Because the answer isn't no, and the answer isn't yes. But there's some kind of setup going on. Yes, Adam and Eve weren't meant to stay in that garden. So why put them in the garden? So they'd have a taste of the garden. And then they could start singing, we got to get back to the garden. And it's not Woodstock. We got to get back to the garden. And we come in this world and we feel and we know in our hearts and our souls that life can be so meaningful, life can be so beautiful, life can be so profound. We somehow know that in our hearts. Otherwise, it wouldn't be so easy to get depressed and sad. We have very high expectations of life. You're right. Expect the highest. You've tasted the highest, according to Kabbalah. We've all tasted the highest. But now we're in this world to come to recognize it through our own efforts and come to really want it. Really, really want it. And this is the generation. There's a hunger. There's a thirst. This is what the prophets have talked about. But that hunger is not a hunger for bread, and a thirst is not a thirst for water. There's a hunger and a thirst for God in people's lives. People are looking for the presence. People are looking for the presence of a higher reality in their lives. And we don't get it. We find other ways to fill that emptiness. You know, one of the reasons for overeating is people simply feel empty. They're not hungry for food. I walked into Baskin Robbins with my kids. There's a woman sitting there. She took up maybe two or three seats. She had two cones in her hands. She was eating them like this. It was just absolutely tragic. She's not hungry for Baskin and Robbins with all the wonderful flavors it might have. There's another hunger that's just not being satisfied. And people are hungry. And so I try to fill that empty vessel with food, with property, with clothing, with items, and yet something just doesn't fulfill it. You know, it's an interesting thing. There was a shopping mall in America that wasn't doing very well. So they're trying to figure out how to get more people into the mall. So one guy came up with a brilliant idea. Food. We'll simply say to all our participants who come to our mall, free food. Great idea. So they set up these huge tables. Anybody could come in and have some food. And sure enough, they doubled the traffic, the population coming into the mall. And they halved the sales. They couldn't believe it. There are double the amount of people we had before, and now we have half the amount of sales we had before. It doesn't make sense. But you know, it makes a lot of sense. Because they discovered that people buy less when they've eaten. If you want to save money, eat before you shop. Eat before you shop. We're consumers. We're hungry. And we're looking to consume. And if I consume food before I walk in there, I won't buy all this other stuff. I'll feel full, but only for a little while. There's a hunger. And we try to fill that hunger. We try to fill that empty space. The question is, what are we hungering? What are we really hungering? According to the Kabbalah, we're hungering that light. We're hungering that presence. We're hungering for that deep, intense connection to a greater reality reality beyond ourselves. And this is our generation. This is our generation. The sad, sad thing that I'm seeing, I've been involved in Jewish education for over 15 years. And I spoke to this one rabbi, and he said to me, you know, I don't think the problem is whether people believe in God or not. I think there's lots of people in this world that believe in God. He said, but I think the great problem is many, many Jews don't really believe that God's in Judaism. And we have so many of our own people going to many other traditions, New Age books, spirituality. You know, when I wrote my book, Endless Light, I took it to Simon & Schuster. Fred Hills, who's the vice president of Simon & Schuster, said to me, you know, Rabbi, I want you to know, 5 years ago, I would never look at a book like this. But that was 5 years ago. A book about God, 5 years ago, wouldn't sell. But Rabbi, today God is in. He made it after all these years, you know. God is in. Now the question is God in Judaism? Is God in our Jewish identities? Is there spirituality? Is there a rich spirituality and excitement in our Jewish path? In our Jewish path. You know, I met with, I won't mention names, but I met with a particular person in Hollywood, a famous star. And this star I just met with, I can't remember his name, I can never pronounce his name, Chakra Chupek, whatever his name is, Endless Body, what? I can never remember his name. Anyways, this star tells me that, Rabbi, I want you to know, he's giving me a mantra. He's giving me a mantra. All right. So I came over to visit with the star and I said, do you know the Jewish mantra? She said, no, there's a Jewish mantra? I said, yes, but it's called a shmantra. She said, a shmantra? What's a shmantra? I said, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. She'd never heard of it. She'd never heard of it. We are looking. We are looking. Everyone's looking. And we are searching. Some of us are more obvious about it. Some of us are more open to admit it. Some of us aren't even aware that we're searching for something in our lives. But I believe we're all searching. We had a taste of the light. I hope I gave you a little taste of the light. I hope I'll have the opportunity to share with you more tomorrow.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelite.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.